Okay, are there any preliminary issues or questions to address? We left off yesterday talking about kind of the mechanics of doing the calculation of economic damages. I wanted to say one more thing about that, or at least a sort of related issue, and that's the idea of something called a structured settlement. Ordinarily, when a plaintiff gets a verdict and damages are awarded, the judgment is in the form of a lump sum. It's, you know, $100,000 or what have you that the plaintiff is entitled to collect from the defendant. Now, in cases where a settlement is arrived at between the plaintiff and the defendant, it doesn't necessarily need to be in the form of a lump sum. In fact, the idea of a structured settlement is to substitute a series of payments for a lump sum. And these series of payments would be the monetary or financial equivalent. We talked about the way in which, you know, a mortgage is a way of getting money now to buy a house and then you pay it off over time. Well, a structured settlement is like an annuity. If you are familiar with the world of annuities, you can give money to an insurance company and then they will make periodic payments back to you either through the course of your life or for a fixed period of time depending on the way the thing is done. Now, a structured settlement can be done in a way that says, the defendant agrees that for the next 10 years, the defendant will pay the plaintiff $10,000 a year, and then after that, 10 years after that, for example, the defendant will pay the plaintiff some a residual sum. Now, there are a couple of reasons why these are advantageous. The first advantage is that many defendants, like the rest of us, prefer paying things over time as compared to having to come up with the cash today. We could use the money for other things in the meantime, and we're okay with the idea that we'll pay a little bit more with interest later on, but we get the use of our money today. Secondly, some plaintiffs prefer not having the responsibility of figuring out how to invest that money. If, in fact, I need the money over time, I can't just take the money and blow it. I need to husband my resources here for needs I'll have later on. So, for example, if it's a 10-year-old child who's receiving compensation for a serious injury and needs ongoing medical care, needs rehabilitative care, needs special educational assistance, and so forth, that money needs to be invested, and the burden of investing it, figuring out where to put the money and how to get a good rate of return but not put it at great risk. In many cases, it's preferable for a defendant that's already a large company, an insurance company, or a big institution like Avista Utilities or Comcast or some other institution that has lots of money and is already in the financial market, let them, in effect, do the investing, use the money for their own purposes, and then receive payouts from them over time. The final advantage is that there's a tax benefit, particularly when it's stretched out over a long period of time. As I think I mentioned yesterday, the IRS treats the receipt of compensation for personal injury as it does not treat that as income, even though it might be based upon lost income. At one time, the IRS tried to track the compensation according to whether it was replacing income, and then it would treat it as income, or not, in which case it wouldn't, and then it gave up on trying to make that distinction, said essentially, so long as it's a receipt of compensation for personal injury, whether in the form of a settlement or a judgment, it's not taxable. However, if you receive the money in a lump sum and then you invest the money, whatever money you earn through investment, interest or dividends or things like that, capital gains, that is taxable. So if I arrange with Avista Utilities, let's say, that in 10 years they're going to pay me this much money, and 15 years they're going to pay me this other amount of money, and so forth, stretch it out over a long period of time, in 15 years' time, I'll get a sum of money that, when I receive it, is not taxed. Whereas if I took the same amount of money today, again, reducing it back to present value, and invested it, I would have to pay taxes on the earnings for that investment. So again, there are a variety of advantages to structured settlements, and that's why when it comes time to arrange for a settlement, it's often done in that fashion rather than in the form of a lump sum. There are a couple of wrinkles to this, however. One wrinkle is that the plaintiff wants some reassurance that the defendant will still be around to make the payments. There's some risk that by trusting that Avista Utilities will make this payment in 10 years or 15 years, maybe Avista Utilities will hit financial difficulty and they'll be out of business. To compensate for that, it's possible for the payor to get insurance. They can go out into the secondary market and get an insurance company or someone else to guarantee, essentially sort of like co-signing the loan, so that in the event of a default by the primary entity, this secondary entity would take over and pay for it. And that costs a little, but it's something that can be arranged at a modest kind of cost. Another wrinkle is the fact that the plaintiff's lawyer typically wants to get paid up front. So if it's a purely private transaction, the plaintiff's lawyer can arrange for the client's receipt to be put in the form of a structure, but the contingency fee gets paid in a lump sum up front because lawyers don't have any tax benefit. It's all income to them, so they don't benefit from stretching out over time, and lawyers are typically anxious to get their hands on the money as quickly as possible. However, in some cases, for example, Federal Tort Claims Act cases limit the receipt by the plaintiff's lawyer, at least in the case of a minor, to a maximum of a 25% contingency fee. And that's viewed as being, as corresponding to the actual receipt of money by the plaintiff. So if the plaintiff delays the receipt of their money, the lawyer has to delay the receipt of his or her money. That creates a little bit of conflict. But again, most of the time, structured settlements work to the advantage of both parties, and they're attractive for that reason. Any questions, lingering questions about economic damages or the stuff we covered yesterday? Okay, well then let's address the next topic here, which is non-economic damages. And the first case we have in this section is a kind of general question about how we think about non-economic damages. It's not really a case. This Morse case is not, you don't really get any facts or holding or that sort of thing, but But the question that's being posed is, should we think about pain and suffering damages in the same way that we think about damages for things like intentional torts or as a form of punitive damages where mere negligence is not enough to trigger recovery? Or should we think of these kinds of damages as though they were just like compensating someone for their wage loss or for their medical expense? So if you break my arm, I may have damages from the work that I miss. I may have medical expenses. Those have to be compensated. What about the fact that I can't sleep very well at night? I have to take pain medication. I have to give up bowling, which I really enjoy, for 4 months. And for that matter, my bowling game is never quite the same again. I can't quite twist my arm to make the ball go where I want it to. And everybody on the bowling team wishes I would retire. Do I deserve compensation for that as much as I deserve compensation for medical expenses and wage loss, or should we put it in a different category? What says the court on that point in Morris? Mr. LeBanc? Okay, now when we refer to exemplary damages, another name for that would be punitive damages. Yeah, we're making an example out of you. This isn't to compensate the victim. This is to make clear our disapproval of the defendant's conduct. That's exemplary damages. Well, does the recovery of pain and suffering correspond more closely to those kinds of damages, or do they correspond more closely to damages like medical expenses and lost wages? That's the defendant's argument. Does the appellate court buy that argument? And therefore should be classified as compensatory damages. So if we're only in the business of compensating the plaintiff, we're again in this sort of image of refilling the plaintiff's tank, that through the defendant's negligence the plaintiff's lost something and we're trying to bring them back to the place they were before the accident, we not only have to do that with respect to their lost income or money they've had to pay out for medical expenses, we also have to try to refill their tank as best we can with respect to what they've lost by way of pain and suffering or the inability to enjoy things that they were able to do before the accident. They deserve that in a compensatory award, so says the court. Now, it's... we say that here, but it turns out that the division between economic damages and non-economic damages, or the distinction, treating them differently, has been attractive, particularly to legislatures in a variety of arenas. One place where you tend to see it is in the area of wrongful death. So that we may say, for example, where someone dies as a result of the defendant's negligence, well, we want to compensate the family or the estate for the economic loss that's been caused, but we can't hope to compensate for the non-economic loss. So we're not even going to try. it's not necessarily. Some jurisdictions will include a non-economic component, but some won't. So again, even though we say here that economic damages and non-economic damages are part of the whole compensatory package, we may change our minds in particular circumstances. Another place where you'll see it is in deciding what is recoverable in the world of joint and several liability. If I'm deciding to make a defendant liable for all of the plaintiff's damages, not just the portion of the accident assigned to that defendant as compared to the other defendants who also caused the injury, in allocating which of the damages the defendant has to pay, even if the other people can't pay their fair share, we may say, well, they're jointly and severally liable for the economic loss, but when it comes to the non-economic loss, they're only liable for the share assigned to them by the jury. And a third area where you can see this differentiation is in areas like tort reform, where you may say, as a matter of tort reform in different arenas, well, we want to preserve the plaintiff's right to recover for their economic loss, but we want to limit, in various ways, the recovery of damages for non-economic loss. Now, again, these are policy choices, and we'll, as we come to them along the way, you'll see the arguments for or against inclusion or exclusion of non-economic damages. But again, just seeing this as we start out with the proposition that non-economic damages are part of the compensatory package, but we may feel differently about them as compared to economic harm. Okay, now, having said that we think they're part of the package, we still have to figure out how wide to cast our net here. And Spade versus Lynn raises this question of whether or not you want non-economic loss to be essentially an equal partner in all of this. And I think I mentioned before our lady on the train, and here is her moment in the sun, as it were. Can somebody tell us about Spade versus Lynn? Yes, Mr. Brown. Yes. Okay. So she files her negligence claim against the railroad, and what's the defendant's response to her claim for damages? No harm, no foul. Okay. And let's first be clear about what the rule would be if she suffered a modest physical injury. Let's suppose, for example, that a button on the coat of one of these drunk guys cut her across the cheek and drew a little bit of blood. It healed up nicely in 6 weeks. You couldn't tell, you know, it didn't leave a scar or anything, but it did draw a little blood. Or she'd gotten a bruise. You could You could take a little picture if you had your vision phone there, and take a little picture of the bruise, and yeah, there it is, a physical injury. And let's suppose that in addition to that physical injury, she's got all this other emotional trauma here. Is she entitled to that emotional trauma? But not to that portion that would not be expected from a reasonable person. Everybody agree with that, or do we have any... What's our rule with Mr. Johnson? No, I'm not talking about this opinion, though. I'm talking about hypothetically. Right, but remember, we have a rule with respect to people of heightened sensitivity. What's that rule? You kick somebody in the leg, their leg falls off. What's the rule? The eggshell plaintiff rule. That is, if you say, in effect, well, I'll pay for the scratch on her cheek, but I'm not going to pay for all this emotional trauma because a normal person would not have suffered that, our rule has been in for a penny, in for a pound. The eggshell plaintiff, you take your victim as you find them. Remember, again, that's distinguished from a rule that said, I had no way of foreseeing any injury to this person. This was an unforeseeable plaintiff. That argument you can still make, but you can't make the argument, I'm only liable for a little bit of damage because this is a hypersensitive person. That argument doesn't fly. So if this lady had suffered a physical injury with accompanying emotional trauma, the train would be stuck, or the railroad company would be stuck paying for this, despite the fact that it's very unusual and apparently she's just very hypersensitive. Why is the rule different, according to the defendant, where she suffers, where we don't have that scratch on her cheek? We didn't draw blood, we don't have a bruise, but all the emotional trauma is there. Why is the rule different? Okay, and one argument we could make is essentially it's a too much of a burden on the jury to have to separate the fakers from the people with real injury. On the other hand, remember that we routinely assign to the jury the difficult task of assessing credibility and finding out if somebody's exaggerating an injury just to get compensation or if they're really hurt. So why isn't it a sufficient answer to say, sort of, if I've got the right guy, Deacon Jones going through defense in football, you know, I tackle everybody until I find the guy with the ball. Why can't the jury simply be in charge of listening to all the people who have complaints for personal injury, including emotional trauma? And if the jury doesn't like somebody or they think they're not telling the truth, the jury says, no, thank you, but we don't have some artificial rule that says unless you've been physically injured, you don't even get to play this game. First of all, what does the court ultimately decide? Do they... Okay, so again, the rule the court adopts is no physical injury, no recovery for mere emotional harm. And again, this is slightly misleading because we just said in the Morse case, we don't consider it to be, well, that's just mere feeling there. To the extent that you're in pain or you have other kinds of emotional consequences from embarrassment, if the defendant negligently causes me a disfiguring, you know, facial injury, I'm burned and my face is a mess after the burn, and it's difficult for me to have to just appear in public and have people stare at me and all that sort of stuff. That kind of pain, emotional harm, is recoverable. But we say it's not recoverable unless there's a physical injury. Now, again, why? One argument is we don't trust juries, or we don't want to burden them with having to separate the fakers from the real ones. Go ahead. Okay, this is an argument that we'll see at many points in this chapter. It's a so-called floodgates argument, that we're kind of holding back this flood of litigation, and we got to keep a lid on this. If we allow cases like this in, the floodgates will open, we'll be overwhelmed. Is that true? What kinds of claims would be justiciable if we dropped this and we simply said, if you're emotionally harmed by someone else's negligence, even though you don't suffer physical injury, that's fair game for compensation? Is it realistic to think that there would be lots of litigation? How many times in the last 24 hours did someone else negligently cause you emotional harm? I can think of a couple. Now, some of them are relatively modest, but some of them can be substantial. You loan somebody your car, you know, and you tell them, I've got an interview with a law firm downtown at 3 o'clock, make sure you get me my car back on time, and they don't. You know, they get stuck in traffic, they thought they had enough time, you know, and you suffer significant emotional harm. Or you go to the dry cleaner because you've got this wedding coming up over the weekend and they're doing your one good, you know, suit that you're going to wear to this wedding, and lo and behold, they gave it to somebody else. They've got a blue suit there, but it's not yours. And you suffer emotionally, right? I mean, again, in the last 24 hours, you can think of lots of instances in which someone, and you may even be able to think of yourself being the defendant in a case in which your negligence caused someone else emotional harm. Do we really want our tort system to be available for claims like that? The answer that this court gives, and one that has been generally accepted, is no, we don't. Is physical injury always a reliable guide to the severity of injury? That is, where you draw a little bit of blood or you cause a little bruise, well, we know that's a substantial injury, but all the rest of this stuff is just in your head. We don't really think that, but it's a crude but effective way to draw a line. It's a filtering mechanism here. Right. Okay, but it doesn't say, in this case, no recovery for mere emotional harm unless we're really convinced it's genuine. It is, in effect, no matter what your emotional harm, no matter how genuine it is, no matter how many witnesses you have to say, this plaintiff here is the most honest you know, long-suffering person. I know she wouldn't be faking it. I know that she's being scrupulously honest when she describes for you her reaction to this. That doesn't matter. Where we're drawing the line is not between things where we're kind of skeptical and things where we're really sure there's emotional harm. We're drawing the line between a kind of gravity of harm. Where you're physically injured, your emotional harm goes along for the ride. But if there's no physical injury, we count it in that class of experiences in life where people negligently cause you emotional harm. Yeah. Not necessarily. Again, what's changed is the case we get to after Carter. We have to talk about Carter, but the case that I would have to say except is Mrs. Johnson, or you know, Mrs. Johnson's daughter, who goes to the wake, looks into the coffin, says, "That doesn't look like my mom. Doesn't even look like my mom if she were dead." And you know, we say, okay, here's our rule, but you know, sometimes rules were made to be broken, and here's a case where we're going to break our rule. Now, this in turn generates a lot of tension, because if the rule was made to give us guidance and provide some discipline from what would otherwise be tort city, where we're constantly suing one another because of negligently inflicted emotional harm, it's one thing if we say we never do that. It's another thing to say, well, we don't ordinarily do that, but we'll do it for really important cases. And that's where, again, we may say, okay, there are some cases where we will bend the rules, but what's the description of such cases? What are the exceptional cases that justify a departure from our ordinary rule? But again, I want to be clear on at least the rationale for the rule itself, and if anybody has any questions about that or comments, or they're puzzled by why you would have such a rule, we should talk about those. But the general wisdom of saying we need a kind of threshold criterion to separate mere emotional harm from serious injury, well, that's, again, that's our general rule. Mr. LeBanc? Most courts permit, the standard would be physical injury that accompanies, not just physical injury that causes emotional harm. So, for example, in the... suppose through my negligence, I caused this fire, and somebody's running from the fire. I guess some of the first deaths from the California fire were people suffering heart attacks and stuff, frightened by the approach of the fire. So it often happens that severe emotional shock will lead to a heart attack or a stroke or some kind of other physical reaction. So long as you can characterize that as a physical injury, it satisfies our requirement of severity. Mr. Brown? How much of her time? I think even a small amount of her tongue, if she actually bit it off and we could identify it, or we could look at it and yeah, that's a physical injury. Now, a bruise, a drop of blood, these are physical injuries, although they're modest. Where I think you have a more difficult time would be someone, let's say, someone who had a blood pressure condition. They're taking, or they have to do various things to moderate their blood pressure because they're right at that edge where their blood pressure is at dangerous levels. And they experience some emotional stress, and it pushes them over the edge, and now they have to take medication for that blood pressure condition. Or they're diabetic, or they have some other condition where there's a physiological reaction, or at least a physiological consequence. And you can see these things, insulin levels again, or blood pressure levels, where you can say, gee, this has gone to a more dangerous level. They were right here before the accident, suddenly it's up here, and that's at the danger point. I don't know if that's a physical injury or not. Again, you'd have these sort of boundary conditions, and as was suggested earlier, if you hire an expert who will take all kinds of measurements and tests, one of the difficulties, of course, is that we register our emotions physically. So if I've just had a sleepless night and I walk in, you can see I look terrible, as opposed to I come in refreshed from a good night's sleep. So you can see, you wouldn't necessarily call that a physical injury, but you can see the physical manifestation of my emotional stress. I may reflect it in weight gain or weight loss. I may reflect that my hair turns gray or some other physiological change. Does that count as a physical injury? Hard to say. Again, the rule doesn't one of the things about the Carter case is that it tests what's the boundary here between a physical injury and a merely emotional injury. But again, the court's using this as a way at least to moderate their concern about the floodgates. And as I said before, throughout Chapter 3, as we decide whether to include or exclude various kinds of claims, the defendant typically argues we're on this slippery slope here, and the plaintiff wants to get on this toboggan and go, sailing down to the bottom of that slippery slope, and the end of Western civilization is right around the corner. And the court has to decide, well, can we tolerate an expansion of liability for cases like this, or can we not? And at times, as we'll see, the courts decide they can go there, and sometimes they decide they can't. And the people who lose that argument are often dissatisfied with the reasoning or the distinctions that are made. Well, why do you do it here but not there? How can you reconcile these two competing decisions? The other thing I want to clarify is a distinction between what might be called a direct injury. That's the lady on the train. She receives a direct injury as distinguished from what I would call a derivative injury. We'll talk later in the chapter about cases in which the injury that I suffer is derived from a more serious injury to somebody else. My daughter, my sister is hit in a crosswalk, and I suffer from being there while she's killed in this motor vehicle accident. That is what I would call a derivative claim, a bystander or loss of consortium claim, as distinguished from I am the only victim. The lady on the train is not saying, because you hurt this other person, I got a derivative injury. She's saying, you injured me. Mrs. Johnson, or the Mrs. Johnson's daughter in the New York case, same issue. She's the victim. And the question is, what do we do with those kinds of cases? And we're dealing with them now. The so-called, what I will call the derivative claims, we're going to deal with later on in the chapter. They're different in this respect, I would just add. With the derivative claims, you've already got some action against the defendant. The defendant's already having to deal with the underlying claim, and it's a question of whether we add on to it. Here, it's a question of whether there's any recovery at all. So the railroad in Spade versus Lynn says, we don't owe anybody a dime. Whereas in the other cases, the defendant says, well, yeah, I owe money to the family of the girl who's killed in the crosswalk, but I don't have to compensate her sister and her mother and her cousin once removed and the other kids in the third grade class and your pen pal in Malawi and, you know, whatever. You know, again, the problem that we get to later on in the chapter is how do we decide where to draw the line in terms of related parties who are eligible to ask for compensation. Okay, but again, we have this general principle I want to make sure we have digested here, that the ordinary requirement for recovering for emotional injury is to establish that there was a physical injury that accompanied it. Okay, then before we get to the Johnson case that I just mentioned, I want to deal with this Carter case, which is an example of modern toxic tort litigation. As we become more sophisticated about the influences that different aspects of civilization have, chemicals and electromagnetic radiation and so forth, there are more opportunities for people to say, look, you adversely affected my health by exposing me to whatever. And the question is, how do we deal with those claimants? And Carter is an example of that. So could somebody tell us about Carter? Meyer. Mayer or Meyer? Mayer. Okay, so what's his claim? Okay, so one of our issues here is whether he has a physical injury. If you represented the plaintiff, how would you respond to the question whether he had a physical injury? Does he? If you're the plaintiff, the defendant's probably going to die on it, but can the plaintiff say with a straight face that the plaintiff's been injured, physically injured? Ms. McLaughlin? What's different? What's physiologically different about it? Yeah. We don't know how many, but they're probably, I'm assuming that this is what the experts would say, whether he has five of these little corkscrew kind of things, asbestos fibers, or 10 or 20, whatever the exposure is, they're just kind of lurking there. He's physiologically different. If we had enough testing apparatus, we could go do a biopsy or whatever, and we could find one of these little suckers. It's not worth doing. It's certainly not worth trying to remove them all. We can't practically remove them, but they're there. So he could say, I'm physically different because of my exposure. Similarly, if you work around, for a while I did some litigation involving formaldehyde. It was a component in, at the time of the first oil crisis and the huge run-up in heating costs, people injected the walls in their houses with this foam insulation, and one of the ingredients was formaldehyde, which was mixed with something else to produce this foam, and it would emit a certain level of formaldehyde gas into the house. The good news, of course, is that if anybody dies, they'll still be preserved there. People varied greatly. One of the things that it turned out was that people varied greatly in terms of their sensitivity. Some people were extremely sensitive to this, and very small quantities would cause these allergic reactions. Other people, you know, might have a little bit of exposure depending upon, and it was hard to tell. But the other thing that was interesting about the litigation is it turns out that formaldehyde is everywhere. You've got formaldehyde in every cell in your body, for example. It's in spinach and peanut butter and all kinds of things that you eat, toothpaste. It's a very common chemical. So to say that you were harmed by even raised levels of formaldehyde is pretty speculative. But some people with a very modest exposure, I guess the figure here is 1 in 100, actually get the disease. Or that was the guessing about his exposure. He didn't know whether he'd be one of the 99 or one of the one. So what's the court's resolution of this question? He wants a recovery for the legitimate fear he has, or the justified fear that he has, that he's at higher risk for cancer. What's the court's answer to him? Yeah, they acknowledge he's physically different, but they say, in effect, you haven't yet been injured. We'll find out later on whether you're actually, whether this has actually caused you harm. It may be, it's sort of like, you know, having several bullets in the chamber, and you just, you know, you're playing Russian roulette and you twirled the chamber and you pulled the trigger, but we don't know yet whether which cylinder happened to be up against the hammer when you pulled the trigger, and we'll find that out. Why can't he be compensated now for that fear? And there's a very practical reason. We'll probably have to pick that up tomorrow, but there's a practical reason in this case why it would be very awkward to give him a recovery now, and we'll pick that up tomorrow.